And reality in the environmental movement. My last shot at Holden. I leave today at noon, so I get to do lots of things that are outrageous and hopefully will engender some discussion. Maybe they'll even serve as the forum topic tonight. And that's nice because I won't have to put up with any guff. I'll leave. And my basic tenet is that I believe the environmental movement may be, in part, as much of a fiction in terms of some of the rationality that is involved as is the utilitarian philosophy of abuse and utilize any resources we want to at any pace we want to. What I'm calling for, and the topic of this session, is common sense in the environmental movement. I consider myself to be, as do 99.5% of the American public, an environmentalist. Hey, I want forests. I want nice rivers that are clean and have nice salmon swimming in them. I want to see hummingbirds humming around my feeder outside my house. That's not the issue. I don't know of any Americans who don't want those things. We all want clean air. We want to be able to pass things on to the next generation. The question is, how do we most appropriately do that while at the same time providing a modicum of security to the people that inhabit this earth? So, I believe there are some basic tenets that have to be challenged in order for us to come to a rational environmental policy. One, I'm going to call the myth of a risk-free society. So, C-I, society. The myth of a risk-free society. Let me illustrate that. About 20 years ago, some evidence turned up in studies of certain lung cancers that there was a possibility that asbestos was involved in the formation or the initiation of lung cancers because several individuals had reported to hospitals in certain areas of the U.S. and Canada, particularly Canada, demonstrating lung cancer, lung carcinoma. And when scientists see a group of individuals or a number of individuals coming in with the same kinds of symptoms, they tend to do a survey and attempt to analyze the kinds of common threads that are among those individuals. For example, in the Jack-in-the-Box food scare that occurred in Seattle a couple of months ago, the reason they determined it was Jack-in-the-Box was that the first 30 people to come down with the ailment had that in common. They'd all gone to Jack-in-the-Box to eat. Okay. In this case, the thing that these people had in common, many of them had in common, was that they'd all worked in some form in the asbestos industry. Most of them either as miners of asbestos up in Canada or as installers of asbestos in the shipyards of World War II in America. And so the conclusion was tentatively reached that there's a possible link between asbestos and cancer. A hue and cry was raised by the public and by certain environmental groups that forced the politicians in Washington, D.C. to institute a policy which I believe is an abomination. It is the height of stupidity. Pardon my French. There is a possible link between asbestos and cancer, but to be honest, the data is not in on it. The studies demonstrating that link have not been done. It's simply speculative. Science Magazine did a study, and Science Magazine has no, I mean, Science Magazine has absolutely no benefit to publishing the kinds of studies that it does. Its study indicated that there was no direct link between the type of asbestos being utilized in the buildings that we have in America to insulate heat ducts and the type of cancers that were seen. In fact, some of the studies later demonstrated that a more probable common thread among these workers was that they were all heavy smokers. Okay. Now you cannot, when you have a carcinoma, you cannot go back and tell what caused it. It's impossible. You cannot tell what caused it. Only when you have large amounts of data in the bank can you begin to get an idea of the probable causes. At any rate, even if you assume a worst case scenario, first of all, the risk to American life is relatively minimal. The figures are somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 carcinomas over a 10-year period of time that are possibly would possibly be linked to asbestos as a hazard. The cost, and the second point is that the abatement process itself, which called for the removal of asbestos in the early days of the abatement process, caused more asbestos to be liberated into the atmosphere than ever would have been liberated had they not done anything with the pipes. The cost to the American taxpayers of this fiasco over the next 6 years, including the times past up through the present, is $150 billion. That's how much it's going to cost the American taxpayer to abate asbestos. That is, tear up old asbestos tile floors, tear off friable asbestos around pipes in school buildings. Now, I have personal experience with this, and this is one of the reasons I get hot and bothered about it. Okay, I served on the board of directors of Portland Lutheran School. It's a high school and elementary school. And in 1990, we had an opportunity to sell our school and to buy another older school. To move, in other words. And the people buying our property were putting in a shopping center. And it ended up costing us $250,000 to abate the asbestos during the demolition of our building, and $270,000 to abate the asbestos in the new school building. Now, that school building that we purchased had been in operation since 1922. With those pipes in it, and had graduated probably during that period of time 10 or 12 or 15,000 students. Not a single case of asbestos-induced cancer has been turned up among all those people, nor among any of the millions of students graduating from American schools over the past 30 years. Yet you're being asked to foot the bill for a $150 billion project. At the same time, that same federal government subsidizes the tobacco industry, with your tax dollars. They pay farmers to raise tobacco, which has been proven to directly cause 300,000 deaths every year in America. Now you tell me that that's a rational environmental policy. Now, I'm not saying we should not look at risks and evaluate whether the risks are things that we as a society want to take. All I'm saying is there is this kind of mythology that we cannot, we can't afford to have any risks in what we do. I'll give you another example. In the same process of selling the school and buying a new one, it was discovered that on one corner of our property, there was a maintenance shed. During the time prior to our purchase of the school, that maintenance shed was used for bus maintenance by the public school district that owned the school. During our tenure there, which was about 12 years, we rented it out to a guy who did engine maintenance as a living. And he was a low-key operator. He'd have, I don't know, 7 or 8 cars in there a month, total kind of turnover thing. Whenever you sell property these days, if any of you are involved in commercial real estate, realize, you don't just sell a piece of property, you have to do an environmental analysis, okay? To make a very long story short, in this particular case, on the night before we were supposed to close the deal, after 2 years of negotiations, the company buying us, the president called me up and said, this was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he calls me up and he says, we're not going to be able to close tomorrow unless you put $500,000 in escrow tonight. I said, why is that? We found an oil spill on your property. I said, where is that? And he said, at the maintenance shed. Now, in reality, they knew about the oil spill 1.5 years prior, and I have documents to prove that. But at any rate, what it ended up being was there was a drain pipe and a dry well underneath the drain pipe outside the front door of the maintenance shed. And apparently somebody, we don't know who, could have been back 20 years before with the public school that occupied it, somebody poured about 10 or 15 gallons cumulative of waste oil down that dry well. And, you know, this is, if you know anything about car maintenance, you know that this is not an uncommon feature of home car maintenance processes. Routinely, people take waste oil and dump it in the back alley or behind the house or something like that. That's not a big deal. That 15 gallons of waste oil dumped on that dry well caused us to receive a bill for $46,000 for removal of the soil and decontamination. $46,000. What they did is they came in with backhoes and bulldozers and scooped out this dirt and hauled it away to a toxic waste site about 40 miles away where it is buried in a specially designed container. Now think about that for a minute. That's 15 gallons of diesel. Okay, how many of you own a home that's heated by oil? Okay, do you burn any diesel in your house? Okay. Why couldn't we not take that soil sample and simply burn off the diesel in it? What is the greater damage to the environment by doing that compared to burning diesel in your oil-heated homes? It is insanity to pay $47,000 to dispose of 15 gallons of diesel. That is not a sane environmental policy. Now, I grant you that we shouldn't be dumping diesel fuel on our soils. And so I applaud efforts to recycle diesel fuel and to dump waste oil into proper receptacles and carry it to the local mechanic who can recycle it for you and do all those fine things. I'm not opposed to that at all. I'm opposed to the insanity that comes when we don't use common sense in making policies dealing with our environment. Okay? Some of you are old enough to remember, in fact, most of the people in this room are old enough to remember, something that happened just prior to Thanksgiving in 1966, I think. It was called the Great Cranberry Scare. Remember that?
Yeah.
Anybody?
You were in Wisconsin at the time.
Huh? Right? What was the deal? Remember what the deal was?
Can't remember specifically. Was it spring?
What was the effect? No, it wasn't pesticide.
We somehow can eat.
Yeah, right. Okay. It happened, just coincidentally happened to be publicized about 3 weeks before Thanksgiving, which is the big cranberry time, you know, and Thanksgiving dinner, everybody has cranberry sauce, right? You never eat cranberry sauce except at Thanksgiving, right? It just comes out, oh yeah, well, it's Thanksgiving, let's have cranberry sauce. Okay. And so it was splashed across the media. Cranberries cause cancer. All right, so everybody quit eating cranberries that year. Everybody was scared away from it. Nobody ate cranberries. Now, the reality was that scientists had found a chemical in cranberries, naturally occurring chemical in cranberries, which, in great enough quantities, caused some abnormal cancers to form in laboratory animals. Well, now, that's a real problem because people have been eating cranberries for an awfully long time. So, what happened? Well, for about a year, nobody ate cranberries. And cranberry farmers all over America were going wacko because they're losing their cash crop. All of a sudden, nobody died from cancer. And so we eat cranberries once again, and you never give it a second thought. You go to the store, buy your cranberries, and go home happy, and don't worry about it. In fact, it's now been demonstrated that cranberries are great for the urinary system. Marvelous, okay? Is eating cranberries a risk-free enterprise? No. You can get cancer from eating cranberries, but more likely you'll choke on the cranberry and die from that. So what is the potential of attaining a risk-free society? It's not possible to attain a risk-free society. Another example, more recent, was the ALAR scare that really hit Central Washington and North Central Oregon. ALAR was a chemical compound placed on the apples to prevent them from, as I understand it, to prevent them from ripening too quickly so they get fatter and bigger and healthier apples for the marketplace. And these studies, again, leaked out that concluded that ALAR could cause cancer. So there was this big boycott of apples all over the United States and nobody ate apples. Now the reality is that if you do your studies well, you'll find that in plants there is an interesting ecological phenomenon called allelopathy. I'll write that word down because it's an interesting word.
That's an I or an E, first letter?
A. It's an A, allelopathy. If you know any genetics, alleles are two things that are very similar to each other. And pathy means something bad, disease or something like that. So these are two things that are living close to each other that are bad for each other. Now, allelopathy is a very important positive feature of the ecosystem, particularly in arid locations. You got a big problem if you're a plant living in the desert. It's called water. You need a lot of it, and there ain't much of it, okay? So how is it that plants can survive in the desert? Well, one of the mechanisms that desert plants have developed is that they give off chemicals that are toxic to other species of plants around them. That gives them growing space and allows them to have a greater pool of water from which to draw. That is true of most plants, that they have allelopathic substances associated with them. They are toxic substances. Now, we're aware of some of them in greater popularity than others. For example, some of the mushrooms, like the death cap mushroom, have tremendous amounts of toxic chemicals in them. But there is this misunderstanding about toxic chemicals in that we believe that there are only certain plants that are toxic and all other plants are good. It's the falsity. What there is an entire spectrum of toxic materials in plants. And obviously, we have a major problem if we're vegetarians, if we avoid eating plants, because we're afraid of the toxic chemicals. There are actually 150 chemicals in some of the most common vegetables eaten by us, that are cancer-inducing, if given in high enough quantities to laboratory animals. By the way, let me just back off and say one more thing about that issue in itself, and that is we make a big, big mistake in equating studies done in laboratory animals with studies done in humans. Because the metabolic processes in other organisms are not the same as they are in humans or in any other organism for that matter. A mouse is different from a cow, is different from a giraffe, is different from a human. They each have their own series of metabolic processes, and the way they deal with certain materials in their metabolism is very unique. So the fact that a mouse gets a cancer from eating certain materials is no link, definite link, to humans getting cancer from that same material. That's just a caveat that all researchers understand, but many lay people do not. Now, why do we use mouse models then? Well, for one thing, they're a lot easier to obtain than human volunteers. Okay, and for another thing, they grow a lot more rapidly. Okay, so I mean, a mouse typically, if you treat it well, lives about a year, and then it dies anyway of old age. So obviously, there's some metabolic differences between humans and mice, just on a most fundamental basis. The model systems that we develop are only very tentative, and then of course, trials on higher animals are attempted, but they become progressively more difficult simply because the animals aren't available, they're very expensive, there are ethical questions involved. I mean, it would be really nice to try it on human beings, but again, the ethical questions are very grave. So when we see these studies talking about the amounts of certain chemicals that cause diseases in laboratory animals, always read that with a bit of caution. Another example, I think, of attempting to have a risk-free society is the example of the automobile industry. And here again, I'm calling for environmental common sense. Let's go back to 1974 in Lafayette, Oregon. Okay, Lafayette's a little suburb near Dundee and Newburgh, out west of Portland. Railroad crossing there. School bus went across, the railroad crossing got stuck, got hit by the train, and two children were killed. As a result of that accident, the state of Oregon passed new legislation for the modification of school buses. They modified the school buses to now double enclose the gas tanks in a double steel housing, to make the frame of the school bus much more rigid with much heavier steel girders, to include sub-girders that ran under every seat so that every seat is totally bolted down. Okay. Now, at first glance, of course, we would all say, why, certainly, we want to protect our children. We consider that a priority. And indeed, from a rational point of view, if we think it through, we may conclude that that kind of modification of a school bus makes sense. I'm not arguing against it, I'm just trying to make a point here. What happened, however, was that in 1974, a school bus cost, a brand new 47-passenger school bus, cost $24,000. In 1975, in the state of Oregon, a brand new 47-passenger school bus cost $36,000. It increased the cost of the school bus by 50%. Who paid for it? You did. Taxpayers. Okay? And that, of course, is true in the automobile industry as well. We now have the push to have airbags in front of everybody in the automobile. We're attempting, in essence, to make automobile driving a risk-free operation. Now, is it sensible to do those things? Well, from an environmental standpoint, increasing the weight of the school bus by about 15 to 20% is not very bright, because you're causing those school buses to use tremendously greater quantities of gasoline, polluting the atmosphere and causing people to die from noxious fumes and cancer-causing agents that are being spewed out in the atmosphere. So the question is, those two fatalities from the school bus in the state of Oregon, which are, by the way, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the last two fatalities in the state of Oregon, and were, I think in the entire history of state school transportation, we have maybe a total of 15 or 16 children that have been killed in school bus accidents. So we're talking in the state of Oregon, at any rate, of something that's a very rare happening. We're trading those lives, making it possible to decrease the risk to those lives. Notice that I didn't say eliminate it, even with all those modifications. If that school bus gets hit by a cement truck at 50 miles an hour, those kids are going to die. And if that school bus goes off a mountain road, that frame ain't going to help those students. They're going to die, you know. So you're not eliminating the risk, but you think you are by doing these things. The question is, does that increased expenditure equate to a rational, logical thing to do? I'm not sure that it does, and I think we need to think those things through. America can do those things in a way that no other country can. 90% of the world would never consider doing that. I was talking to Keith, the guy that works in Narnia, and he was telling me about his trip to Peru last year, or a couple years ago. He went to Peru, and he took a trip from Lima back into the boonies. They drove for 4.5 hours on a school bus that was packed to the gills with people. You know, probably didn't have brakes. It was, you know, you get the picture. The people all over the world are being transported in things that are not safe. Now, do we want that? No, of course not. But the economic realities are that we're the only people in the world who can afford that. And it's sort of another example of, if you will, our disdain for the rest of the world. We spend money to save a few lives, when if we take that money and send it someplace else and allow them to get a set of brakes on their bus, we could probably save 70 lives in that other country. That's the kind of thinking that I want us to carry out. I want us to see the global impact of our environmental realities rather than just the local things. Holden Village, let's get to Holden Village. I said I'd knock Holden Village a little bit today. I love Holden Village, it's a great place. A little weird, but it's pretty great. Okay. I just did garbology this morning. Very interesting effort on the part of Holdenites to do their thing for the environment. And to be quite honest, it's a nice thought. But in terms of the realities of what it accomplishes, if Holden Village were really concerned about the environment, they would ask people to stay in Minnesota. Because the jet fuel that they spent flying to Seattle and the car fuel they spent driving to Chelan and the boat fuel they spent boating up to Holden, far by magnitudes of thousandfold orders, outweighs the benefit that comes from us separating gum wrappers from tissue paper up in the garbage dump up there. I mean, let's get real. What are we really trying to do here at Holden Village? If we're really going to be environmentally sound, let's quit this nonsense of having all these people retreat to the mountains. You know, I think it's sort of, in a sense, a way of assuaging our guilt. We come up here for 2 weeks, you know, and then we do garbology once, and we've done our bit for in the environment for the next year, and then we come back to Holden, and we go back to Seattle, or we go back to Minneapolis, or wherever we live, and we do the same things at home, and we always did. You know, we throw the garbage in the big dump. In fact, I heard it. A woman who was sitting with breakfast with me said, the thing I look forward to the most when I get home is I have this big green dumpster in front of my house. I can put it all in there, and the garbage man takes it away. I don't have to worry about it. Let's get real. Who are we trying to kid? Okay. They have all these signs up there, you know. If it's yellow, let it mellow. If it's brown, flush it down. All those kinds. What that tells me is they got a lousy designed sewage system. They don't have a big enough drain field. Let's not blame us for that. Let's get a better drain field. I mean, these are environmental myths. We don't do anything for the environment by not flushing the toilet. There, we got water out our wazoo here in Washington and Oregon. You know, and you can't do anything with it. It's just running down Railroad Creek and out to the ocean. If you flush your toilet once or twice more, you aren't saving anybody in Somalia. That water's still going to end up down in the ocean anyway. You know, so it, I guess what I'm asking you to reconsider, I want you to be radical. Holden is too conservative. They don't, the thinking here is too mainstream, too politically correct to actually think about the consequences of what's happening. And if you really want to do something about it, then what you got to call for are radical changes in lifestyle, not sorting garbage. That, in reality, that's going to work fine for a suburbanite. You can do it. I do it. I have a compost pile behind my house, much to the chagrin of my neighbor who comes over and yells at me all the time because it stinks. But, you know, she won't do it for her house, and nobody else on her block does it. And you can bet your sweet bippy that nobody in the high-rises has a compost pile. And most of the people who live in New York City or Detroit or Chicago or Philadelphia or any big cities, which amounts to most of the people in the world, don't have a chance to have a compost pile. You know? So let's talk about environmental realities. What are some of the things we can do? Okay. Well, we can stop having lots of kids. But we've already stopped, essentially. North Americans are not the problem. Western Europeans are not the problem. In terms of population density, our population has pretty much stabilized. Our population is increasing because of immigration, but it's not increasing because of childbirth in America anymore. Northern Europeans have stopped. In fact, their population in many places like Poland is decreasing rather than increasing at all. Now, then you get into some real ethical problems of us telling them that they have to stop having children. Easy for us to tell them they should stop having children, because we're using their food and we're using their oil and we're using their money. So they don't see it that way. And I think we have to ask some real hard questions about whether we have the right to tell other people how to live their lives. In terms of our environmental realities, what you can do personally, I believe, is exactly what Rob Wall was talking about with James this morning. We are a materialistic society, much more so than we were 30 years ago. And then we were more materialistic than we were 30 years before that, and we're getting more materialistic as time goes by. Think about it a minute. Just think about it a minute. In your own experience, is this not true? You know, you now have in your house, if you're a typical Holdenite from Minneapolis or Seattle, 3 color TVs. And probably at least 1 or 2 VCRs someplace around the house, or a Nintendo game, okay, or some combination thereof. You have at least 2 cars in your family. You have perhaps the latest in what they call envirotech. I love that term. Envirotech stuff, like mountain bikes. Okay, you have all these mountain bikes because you think you're doing the environment so much good. So you buy mountain bikes. Okay, they're made of tungsten steel. Tungsten's a very rare element. You have to mine it. You have to gouge mountains apart to make the tungsten alloy that that your Envirotech bike is made out of. Okay, and you get an L.L. Bean catalog every other month. Okay, all full of the latest Envirotech clothes, Patagonia, Columbia sportswear, Nike, you know, the right kind of hiking shoes. You know, it's just not shoes anymore. You have to have the right kind of hiking shoes. I have a gal on my basketball team when I was coaching college ball, and we had sort of a team dinner at her place, and she was living in this basement apartment, and I walked in there, and I couldn't believe my eyes. She had 18, count them, 18 brand new pair of Nike shoes on the wall. All of them different colors and slightly different styles, but most of them I'll bet she hadn't worn more than 3 times. 18 pairs of Nikes, okay? She had on this wall, she had probably 30 different sweaters, conservatively. we just have so much junk, you know. I've been made aware. I mean, I'm guilty. Hey, you're not talking to some saint here. I'm guilty. I do things like this too. Okay, we just had the experience of buying a new house, and we're moving. That's what I'm going home today to move. We're moving next week. Fun. Okay. We had the great American pastime, a garage sale. Do you think they had garage sales 100 years ago? Never. Okay. You know what the great symbol of American materialism is? The rental space places that have popped up all over the place. You know, you don't have enough room in your house to store it anymore, so you got to go rent another garage someplace to store all the crap you got. You don't even know what to do with it all. That's America. What a place. What a place. You know, if you really want to be environmentally sound, quit buying so much stuff and give your money to poor people. That's how you become environmentally sound. Okay. There are lots of other myths we could get into. Now, I have some other problems with the environmental movement that I wish to share with you. One is, I think the environmental movement, to a large degree, is a bunch of sheep who like to be led. And they are led very well by lots of people, and I believe that the leaders are not necessarily what the environmentalists think they are. I had a conversation with one of the staff people here who used to be a member of the Sierra Club, and many of you may be members of the Sierra Club. Now, Sierra Club started out to be a laudable organization with laudable goals, and still does some very fine things for the environment. And don't get me wrong, I'm not condemning everything Sierra Club does, nor am I condemning environmentalists. I'm just saying, let's use our heads. Okay? What Sierra Club has become is another bureaucracy. It has become a national organization headed up by lawyers and politicians who make big bucks off of the environmental movement. Okay? If you think that's not true, you don't understand the processes. Okay, this $47,000 that we're going to pay, we're supposed to pay for this oil spill that occurred on our school property, is being challenged in court by us. Guess who the big winners in this are going to be, no matter what? The lawyers. Okay, and I'm not here to knock lawyers. I'm just saying that our legal fees already in this amount to $12,000, and we haven't even gone to trial yet. That's our legal fees, and their legal fees are probably at least that. So we got another $24,000. So we got over $70,000 tied up in 15 gallons of diesel. That's pretty good. As you talk about black gold, that's black gold. How many of you think it's bad policy to use styrofoam cups? Now, come on, raise your hand, right? Everybody, oh, styrofoam, terrible stuff, right? Do you realize that the studies done on the comparisons between styrofoam and paper indicate that it's really a wash? There's really not much difference. And actually, the studies done on whether you use ceramic pots, cups, and then send them through a dishwasher, which requires tremendously hot water and detergents in order to get the stuff clean, and the amount of time it takes to get them clean, the trade-offs make it so that the three of them are probably equal options in terms of their effect on the environment. But we yet have this, we got to get rid of the styrofoam, kill it, you know, and all this stuff. How many of you drink hot coffee out of paper cups? Not if you can help it, right? Why?
Don't taste good.
Tastes different and?
The cup's hot.
The cup's hot. So what do you do? You put two cups. You use two cups. And that's exactly what happens. People use two paper cups instead of one styrofoam cup. Is that environmentally sound? I think not. You have to, in other words, don't be led. Don't be led. Think for yourself. Consider the realities. Consider the alternatives. Think about what's going on around you. Go ahead, Ed.
It's the styrofoam, and I've kind of bought into it. I really like what you're saying, but I like your approach, but is that really true?
It's absolutely really true.
I mean, I had this impression that you put styrofoam in the bar, it just stays there forever.
So does paper.
Oh,
You know the wax-covered paper like you have in these, or the not wax-covered, but these, actually most paper cups they use for coffee are plastic-lined cups. Right. They take 150 years to decompose in landfills. Okay, so the change between that and the styrofoam, which probably takes 250 years to decompose or 300 years to decompose, is really, over the long haul, kind of non-essential. I think the bigger questions are, how much energy does it take to produce? How much energy does it take to move these cups from place to place? Aesthetically, which is more pleasing? How does it help life or hinder life to do these things? I mean, my own impression is, personally, what I'd rather do is, I think a sane solution at Holden is, instead of having us use these coffee mugs like this, what we should do is put a wall up where everybody has their own coffee mug for the whole week. And you don't have to wash them between each setting. Just go up, grab your coffee mug, get some coffee, drink it, put it back on the wall. And I mean, you do that at home. You know, we do it in coffee in the office all the time. You don't sit there and go put it through a dishwasher every time you get done drinking a cup of coffee. That's what, and one of the reasons, in fairness to Holden Village, one of the reasons they do that is federal regulations or state health regulations. You have to wash the dishes every time you do it. You know, so anyway, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I really appreciate your point of view on this and looking at the bigger picture. But the thing with things like chemicals in the environment is that people don't really understand what the risks are. For example, you know, we've talked about pesticides, for example. We really don't know what the risks are to people because it's a very hard thing to quantify and to study. And so that is in itself, you know, scary for people, the unknown. And I think it's, you know, I think there are lots of risks, but a lot of them we really don't have any sense of what the risks are. And the other thing that I think you didn't mention with the asbestos, which I think was a part of that, is the synergistic effects between different types of chemicals that we're exposed to.
Let me respond to that.
I mean, you're talking about risk assessment, and there's lots of different risks, and which ones are acceptable and which aren't. But, I mean, it's hard to get a picture of that.
Well, I don't think it is. I think it's pretty simple to get a picture of it, and we've made it much too complex. And the simple picture is this. Before the advent of chemical additives to the environment, the average American lived 47 years. Since the advent of chemical additives to the environment, the average American lives 77 years. In 85 years, but those are chemical additives to the environment. Antibiotics have risks. If you know anything about medicine, you know that if you take antibiotics, there is a huge risk compared to pesticides, a huge risk that the antibiotic will have a reaction in your body and kill you. Much greater risk than any pesticides that we're dealing with in the environment right now that have been approved by FDA. The question also is that you're ignoring the risk of not using the pesticide. That is to say, the decrease in productivity by not using the pesticide. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not saying we should go out and spray everything willy-nilly. What I am saying is you can do rational studies, thoughtfully done, consider the alternatives, and find out if indeed the pesticide is as bad as you say it is. For example, dioxin, right? If you read any of the literature, you'll find out dioxin is the most toxic substance ever known to man. Okay, that's the common consensus on it. But in what ratio? In what percentage? And how do you get dioxin into your system? Okay. The studies done across the world on 2,4,5-T, which is the herbicide that has as a side product of its production minute quantities of dioxin, indicate that in agricultural use, as we do all across America and across Canada, the levels of dioxin that accumulate in the fat of animals is so minuscule that in order to induce cancer using dioxin, you would be required to eat 5,000 pounds of beef a year.
Okay. It's probably based on animal studies, probably, most likely.
Yeah, it is. I'm not saying that's not. But the flip side of it, which is not considered, is that because of the proper use of pesticides, and again, there is some proper and some improper use of pesticides, because of the proper use of pesticides, we've been able to increase productivity in the American farm since 1930 by 75%. We now raise 240 bushels of wheat on an acre of land that in 1930 would only raise 180 bushels of wheat. And as a result of that, we are the biggest exporter of food in the world. And we feed China and Russia and South America and many places that don't have food. That's why we can fly to Somalia and dump food in there to the starving people. Okay? So the not increasing the productivity and not having that food availability kills other people because there's not food to feed them. Now, it would be great to have a perfect world and not have any risks and, you know, be able to do all these things.
I'm not talking about no risk, but I still think that there's still, I think pesticides, whatever, radioactivity are still in those, that area of unclear risk to society, because I don't think they've been studied enough. I mean, just recently there was a study came out about pesticide and children's health and the long-term risk. I mean, we eat, you know, food every single day. You know, what are the cumulative doses of pesticides or what other chemicals in kids' bodies? I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm not sure you have the data for that to really, really address that risk very well.
I'm not saying
you know that it is a risk, but I want to know what
right.
it is.
I'm not saying that you'll ever that science has all the answers to those questions. I don't think that's possible. And you can't, for example, let me do an analogy with medicine, because this is one that we all assume that there are inherent risks in medicine. I mean, if you ask of physicians to attain the same standard of risk-freeness that you ask of pesticides and other chemicals, no physician in America would operate, ever. They would never be able to do surgery. They would never be able to do anything curative. They would never be able to prescribe medicines to you. In fact, the data on pesticide use in America is pretty telling. The data is something like this. This is off the top of my head, but the order and the magnitude is approximately correct. In America, 7,500 accidental poisonings per year can be attributed to pesticides. Most of those, by far the majority of those, household pesticides rather than farm pesticides. That is, there by far a majority of accidental poisonings come from little kids getting a bottle of diazinon or something like that and drinking it. So 7,500. Cosmetics in America cause 8,500 poisonings. Household cleaners cause 22,000 poisonings. And medicines cause 85,000 poisonings per year. So the question is not you're right. You don't want a risk-free society. I understand you don't.
I
don't. The question is, at what level are you willing to accept the risk? And I'm telling you, as long as we live on the face of the earth, there's always going to be unknowns about what you do. And what I believe you have to do is understand that there are going to be inherent risks in any undertaking that attempts to better the situation of mankind. You don't just blatantly do everything that you want to do. You do the best you can. You study the problem with the best scientists you have available to study it. You look at the alternatives, and you come up with a rational solution to the problem, and you do it. And you understand that you're going to lose sometimes. That's the name of the game. But overall, still, bottom line is American health has never been better than it is today. Never. You know, and we're one of the top six countries in the world in terms of national health. So, you know, that's hard to argue against. Go ahead, way over here, Craig.
One of the things that I think we don't take into consideration, you go way back to your school bus example, how many extra resources are we impacting by trying to make ourselves more safe? And I think you can apply that across the board, whether you're talking about pesticides or other chemicals or cleanup of toxic spills or whatever. We think about the immediate problem that's right here, that's right before us, but we don't think about the ripple effect going out of how many more resources we're using, and in the long run, are we really wasting those?
Right.
Or are we being frivolous with other people's resources in the world?
That's a great point. It was just in the Seattle Post-Intelligence, yesterday's issue had an article on the, is it the Elwha River or some ELWHA River in the Olympic Peninsula, okay? And they're trying to reestablish the salmon runs, and they're saying exactly what I said yesterday. The only way to do it on that river is blow up the two dams that are there. They have a dam 4.5 miles from the ocean and another one up further, and the salmon can't migrate properly. And so the conclusion by the Corps of Engineers is, and the fisheries people in conjunction with each other, is we're going to have to blow up the dam. The only problem is these two dams provide power for a pulp processing plant near there that employs something like 140 individuals. Okay. Now, here's what the congressman from the state of Washington did. They said, okay, we'll agree to blowing up the dams if you provide that company with cheap electrical power to replace the power that they're going to lose from the dams. And that's what you're saying. That's a lack of vision to the big picture. Because obviously, what's going to happen then is we're going to save the salmon run in this river, but we're going to do that by creating a air pollution from a coal generating plant someplace else, or building another dam on another river, because there's no other energy to replace it with unless you do that. So you can't have your cake and eat it too. You got to come to some understanding that there are no perfect answers to environmental solutions or questions. Yeah.
You started by saying most of us want a better environment and want to do what's necessary to make that happen. Could you comment on any view you have about how do we affect public policy to do it differently than we're doing it today? Today we have Food and Drug, we have NIH, we have NSF, we have different agencies that try to tell us what truth is in these matters. And like the gentleman across the room, I thought styrofoam lasted forever in the landfill, and therefore we shouldn't use that. That's my understanding of truth. How do you propose public policy to address the issue and keep us more current?
Well, first of all, I believe that one of the big problems in America is trust. And this may sound ironic, but until there can be a level of trust between the populace and the government, we'll never have effective policy, because the people won't vote for effective policy if they don't trust the people that are leading the nation. And I believe that there are two possible scenarios, at least, for the ultimate resolution of environmental problems. The one is, part of my agreement with a theory called the Gaia hypothesis that some of you may have heard about, and I'm going to talk about that in closing. That's going to be my last kind of comment. But the other is that we will have a reawakening of this idea, and it fits in pretty nicely with what I've been talking about, that we cannot expect perfection either in our leaders or in our institutions or in our chemicals, for that matter. What we have are sinful human beings trying to do the best job they can. When we get to the point where we're at right now, I think, and we're getting worse as time goes on, Bill Clinton may be the nicest guy in the world, but he ain't going to be able to accomplish squat, because nobody trusts them, okay? Or a lot of people don't trust them. And your congressperson may really be sincere, but they're not going to be able to accomplish much if we don't trust them. Now, trust has a tremendous risk component to it. It means you're going to get burned every once in a while. But the alternative, I believe, is anarchy. The alternative is we never allow our government officials to govern. We don't trust them enough to do that. Now, so I have two possible resolutions. One is we turn to trust and forgiveness, you know, if you will, as a more rational, sane way of doing business as a government and people, which may sound extremely naive, but I think ultimately that may bear it out. Or the other alternative is the world will take care of itself. Gaia hypothesis is this hypothesis that came from James Lovelock in England about 10 or 12 years ago, in which he made the earth into a living being. So the idea is that the earth is not some kind of planet spinning around in the universe, but rather the earth and the all the organisms and chemical ecosystems that are on the earth are part of a living organism. And so it responds just like you do. If you get an upset stomach, you vomit, you know. And the earth does the same thing. If it gets sick, it does something in response to it. Now, in that sense, I agree with it. Because I tend to think we take ourselves far too seriously. We take ourselves far too seriously. We're much less capable of altering the environment than we think we are. Okay? There's no way on God's green earth that we're going to kill off humanity. Nor are we going to destroy the ecosystems of the world. The ecosystems of the world are going to take care of themselves. Now, they may take care of themselves in a very nasty way by having a lot of us starve, which is a likely scenario down the road. But they'll take care of themselves. Global warming, for example. I don't fear global warming. The worst predictions of global warming are a 9 degrees Celsius increase in the global temperature, global climate. Okay? When the dinosaurs lived on the Earth, we were 17 degrees Celsius warmer than we are right now. And if you think about it a minute, the idea that by burning fossil fuels, we're going to change the climate of the Earth so much that no life can exist anymore is preposterous. Because all we're doing is taking a store of carbon dioxide that's now in the soil, and where did it come from? It was at one time living plants on the face of the Earth and got deposited there through time, and we're releasing it in the atmosphere. That's going to warm us up. It's going to warm us up. I don't think there's any question about that. But Gaia tells us that it will also eventually go under an equilibrium situation, because the more carbon dioxide and the more warmth we put in the atmosphere, the faster green plants grow, because they use carbon dioxide for food and they need warmth to grow. You know that. That's why you put plants in a hothouse. Get them warm, give them a lot of carbon dioxide, they grow fast. So what's going to happen over the face of the Earth is you dump all this carbon dioxide in, we're going to grow forests more rapidly, going to grow phytoplankton out in the ocean more rapidly than we do now. And that stuff's going to eat the carbon dioxide. So there's going to be a balance reached. We're not going to kill ourselves with carbon dioxide. We take ourselves far too seriously. You know, think about all these people with their recycling efforts in the Mississippi River Valley, and oh, Mother Nature comes in and whoosh, there goes your recycling efforts. They're all washed down into the Gulf of Mexico in one fell swoop. You know, we are really tiny characters on this earth, and we need to appreciate with some humility what our role is and what our role is not. I'm not saying we can't damage the environment, but the environment, God, I think, has created us in such a way that we don't need to fear that. That's sort of the passage that I quoted in one of my other talks, Romans 8:38-39, you know. There's nothing in heaven or earth that can separate us from the love of God. We don't have to be worried about that stuff. So don't be a doomsdayer. Think carefully and rationally about decisions that you make. Any other questions?
Just kind of like a styrofoam, you know, I thought it was a no-no. And then here you say, well, geez, the earth, you know, has its self-corrective mechanisms to it. It's a live organism. Well, how about, like, heading? The other thing I've kind of accepted as an environmental truth is that all the cars, and I was driving all the cars, all the carbon monoxide, all that kind of stuff is just awful.
It is. It's terrible.
And that we should really need to find a way to curb that, find solar cars or something, you know, some other vehicle, you know,
yeah.
Means to do that. But
no, what we should do is not drive cars. Because if you build a solar car is you trade off the resources. Okay, instead of using oil or coal or gasoline to power your car, you're going to use a solar panel, which is a nice theory because you say the energy comes from the sun. That's great. But you have to make the solar panel. And the solar panel takes lots of resources. And if you try and put the kinds of numbers of cars on the face that we have right now made out of solar with solar panels, you're going to be raping the earth to do it. The alternative is not making solar-powered cars. The alternative is not driving, which is why I predict McDonald's will be out of business in 25 years, because people won't drive. I don't think you're going to see an alternative energy source that makes driving as easy as it is today. We're at the peak in utilization of resources, and we just can't keep doing it.
I disagree.
Well, you may disagree, but I don't see us finding